But today, the next maybe 45 minutes, we are going to hear about her insights and editorial insights into scientific publishing. And of course, this we never had this kind of plenary talk in the nanoscience days in the last 15 years. And we put a lot of pressure for you to teach us how to get papers through in the nice journals that we always like to publish. So let's thank Ariane and welcome Ariane to the stage. Thank you.
Well, it's great to be in Finland. It's my first time in Finland, and not only that, last night was my first time in a Finnish sauna, and I have to say, spending time with half the audience in a sauna is a great way to break the ice and warm me up for this talk. So that was really fun. Hannu already did a great job of introducing me. I'd like to thank, of course, the organizers, Hannu, for hosting and inviting me to this conference. So I'm going to cover a bunch of topics. It's really hard to add figures to a talk about publishing unless I want to add a lot of tacky clip art, which I didn't. So you can actually find the slides online right now. Go to this link. I'll also post a link at the end, and that way you can access all the advice text that's on here. One note, this is a capital O. Apparently, if you put a lowercase O, you'll go to a blog about Uber. So I tested that this morning, so please use the capital O. But basically, the topics we'll cover is how to prepare a submission. That includes writing a good cover letter, convincing the editors, how to write a compelling paper. And then I'll kind of go through the editorial decision process. So pre-review, how we decide to send things out to review. I'll go into a lot of depth about the peer review process, and that includes how we pick reviewers, how to be a good reviewer, and then editorial decisions post-review. So what do we do with mixed reports? What do we do with reviewers who don't like your work but you find them biased? How do we deal with all of that kind of politics? And then I'll give you some advice for doing good revisions, response letters, and appeals if it does come to that. Okay, so the editorial process. For many of you, I assume it's you're an author, you submit a paper, and then there's just a big gaping black void. You have no idea what happens after until you get some kind of decision. So my goal is to demystify this process. So as an author, you submit it, you'll have a handling editor, you'll either be rejected, in which case you could appeal or transfer. In Nature Communications, we return approximately 60 to 80% to the author at that stage. Or you might get this peer-reviewed. The editorial process is kind of an iterative process. Then, you know, you either get invited to revise, reject, or you might get accepted. And Nature Comms, we accept about 15%. But this will be a pretty general talk in terms of publishing in general. It won't really be a Nature Communications-specific talk. So a little bit about me. I got my PhD in chemistry from the University of Illinois in the US. I studied basically surface chemistry of gold nanocrystals, supramolecular chemistry, and kind of assembly of those nanocrystals. Since 2016, I've been an editor at Nature Communications. This is me, and it felt like you could see me. I didn't want to put my picture up there. But I cover essentially nanochemistry, nanocrystals, discrete supramolecular chemistry, so sort of tiny materials and giant molecules. And then I also lead a team of editors that handle computational chemistry, inorganic materials, physical chemistry, and material science. And we are looking for a new person, just saying. So if you're interested in an editorial career and you're about to graduate or a postdoc or even a professor looking to jump ship, actually three of these editors were previously professors and decided to become professional editors. So feel free to talk to me afterwards, and I'll be happy to give you a little bit more information about that. Okay, so preparing a submission. The first step is to select a journal wisely. You know, you might have your work, you might think it's great, you might want to aim for science or nature. But really, there's a few things that you want to consider first. First is the audience. Who do you want to read your work? If it's a work that you'd rather have specialists in your field read and adopt for the lab, you might not want to go for the highest level. You might want to, what kind of journal do you go for when you want to read a work that's like this? So really aim for the journal's audience. Think about the impact and the scope. You know, how big is your work? You know, how significant are the findings? What's the advance over previous works, and where were those previous works published? key is how urgently do you want to get it out? Some journals are known for being a little bit longer than others. Some are very fast, so that might be a consideration. And then accessibility, so is open access important to you or not? Once you're there, you might think about the cover letter, and we get a lot of questions about the cover letter. The thing about the cover letter is mediocre ones really don't make a difference at all. Bad ones also don't really make a difference. Only really good ones make a difference, and so I'm going to give you some tips for writing a really good one that stands out. The first thing is think of it as, you know, you're 5 to 10 minutes alone in a room with an editor. You're standing in front of your poster, an editor comes by. How would you sell the work to them in 5 minutes? Be frank and open. Tailor it to the journal. Don't just copy the abstract. I'm going to read your paper anyway, so tell us something new. Be concise and be explicit and sell the work. Later I'll talk about how not to overhype your work in the paper itself, but in the cover letter, you know, go ahead. Don't be ridiculous, but, you know, feel free to sell it a little. That helps us put it in context. Explain the importance and put the work in context to other literature. And if you think that, you know, other work, we might get confused about the advance of your work over this other work, feel free to tell us exactly what your work does over previous literature. So say, for example, this system has been studied a lot, but only ex situ. You could say, even though these papers have studied this system here, in this work, we really, for the first time, study it in situ, which is important because so-and-so. The way I look at cover letters is I usually read the cover letter first just to kind of frame myself to see what the author wants me to get out of the paper. Then I read the paper. Then I go back to the cover letter and make sure that I got everything that I should have from the paper. This is also where you should mention your suggestions for reviewers, and we do check for, you know, whether they're your previous supervisors, your friends, your current collaborators, so please don't suggest them. Any reviewer exclusions, we always honor them within limits, usually 3 exclusions, or people in opposite camps. So if there's, you know, if your work is directly refuting the work of somebody else, you might want to mention that. And we'll be a little bit careful about inviting reviewers like that. Any related papers that you've submitted elsewhere or that are in press, we'll probably ask to see these because the worst case situation is that, you know, we send your paper out to review, this other paper comes out during then, and then, you know, no one is happy at that point. And any kind of other special circumstances that you might want the editor to know about your work. General advice for writing, how to tell a compelling story. So remember, this is a story. The biggest advice I can give is don't frame the paper as, okay, here's what we've done. You want to frame it as, here's why what we've done is important. And the best way to start, probably even before you're thinking about your research project, but definitely when you're thinking about whether to sit down and write a paper, is make sure that you can summarize your paper with one clear message or takeaway. If you can't summarize it in a simple 1 to 2 sentences, you might be covering too much base. It'll be very hard for a reader to figure out what the point of the paper is if, you know, you can't even do it yourself in a sentence or two. The paper should be simple and focused, so every section of the results, every figure, should all be relevant to the main message. If you have side stories, like side interesting observations, those could be okay to include maybe in an essay or a side note, but you want to be careful of detracting too much from the main story. You definitely want to motivate the study. So, you know, what's the question or gap in knowledge? Why are we reading your paper? Why should we even care? Provide tension, you know, at the beginning, and then as we read the story, we should have that tension resolved. Avoid writing chronologically if possible. So that's the sort of, when you organize your papers, first we did this, then we thought, well, we should do this. So then we did this study, then we did this. Use a logical flow instead. So it should be organized as, you know, all tackling this question, and those should all fit in to answer the question in the most logical way. That may or may not be chronologically, but don't just go in as like a lab report, you know, how you would write it in your lab notebook. And avoid writing descriptively. And by that I mean kind of a compendium of observations. We observed this, then we observed this. I've seen papers that have beautiful data, tons of data, must have taken years. It's really excellent data, but the significance of all these observations isn't clear. And it's really hard to send that out to review because, again, it doesn't have a clear message or takeaway. I can see a bunch of your results, but I don't know what to do with that. So make sure that the significance of every observation or every result that you report is clear and that it comes back to that main takeaway. Second great piece of advice is to explain and don't hype. So, you know, don't tell us how great the work is. Show it. Really good results should speak for themselves. They don't need to be shrouded in really, you know, huge bombastic language. If you oversell your work in the beginning, you'll only disappoint the editor. You know, we come to the cover letter, we're really excited, and then if your work doesn't live up to that, we're already kind of, what's this person trying to sell? Referees also, they will be disappointed. I've seen many papers that come in with big claims, the referees are excited to review, and then, you know, they just, from then on, you're kind of working from a disadvantage because you're always trying to get to what they think your paper is rather than just selling the work honestly and letting the referees build the work from there. So hyperbolic statements like, you know, this remarkable innovative synthesis yields an extremely pure product. Just cut it down and say, this synthesis yields a pure product. The results, the figures, will be able to tell that it's pure, innovative, all that stuff. Instead of, you know, things like this is a paradigm in the shift, paradigm shift in the field. Rarely that's the case. So just make the importance clear. If we decide it's a paradigm shift, great, but you don't need to tell us that. And avoid overt claims of novelty. Sometimes you may not know what other people have done. Sometimes, you know, a month before you submitted this paper, someone else has done a very similar thing. You never want to publish a paper, and to the best of our knowledge, no one has done this because, you know, a referee might have just done that, and then, again, you're at a disadvantage. So instead of saying something like, you know, we report a novel approach or this mechanism is unprecedented, tone it and make it implicit in the context. So we introduce an approach. That already implies that it's new. We discover an unexpected mechanism. The discovery is already implying that it's new. Instead of this is the first example of, or this has never been shown before, you can just say, we address this gap in understanding by doing this. And so the reader already gets the point that this is novel, original. For the title, so don't underestimate the point of a good title. Again, going back to the, can you summarize your work in 1 to 2 sentences, the title should really just be that message. It should be descriptive but concise. Every extra word that you add should add value. Avoid jargon, acronyms, things that would turn people off to the paper. Avoid too many adjectives like facile, mild, scalable, blah, blah, blah. You know, that doesn't add that much value. We just want to know exactly what you did in the most concise way possible. You can include keywords to enhance discoverability, but don't make it sound like a list of buzzwords. For the abstract, when we send a paper out for review, the reviewer can only see the abstract in the title. So this is your time to hook the reader. And again, if somebody's on Web of Science or searching for papers, they're probably reading the abstract first, and that's what decides them to open the paper or not. So do make sure that the question being addressed is crystal clear, that your most important findings are summarized. If you have any critical methodology that's important, so you'll say a computational technique, an advanced in situ X-ray or TEM technique, you can mention that. And then finish it by ending with the implications of your work. You don't need to provide, you know, detailed methods, tons of abbreviations that make it very unreadable, or specifically reference figures that people that are reading the abstract wouldn't even be able to access. For the introduction, okay, set the stage. The editor may not be an expert in whatever paper we're reading. We might have a general idea of the field, but you know, we don't know the specific niches that you all are working in. So make it easy for us. Introduce the question, motivate it, set the background moving from a very general thing down to a specific information, and don't assume knowledge. Don't assume that I'm an expert in your exact field or your PhD advisor. Be selective but scholarly with citations. Sort of a unfortunate thing is that the better you are at citing papers selectively but scholarly, the easier it is for us to tell immediately how novel your work is. So there are a lot of papers that, you know, neglect to cite a lot of important work. We say, ooh, wow, we do our due diligence, we still don't find those references, we send it out to review, and the referees absolutely tear it down, and that doesn't make you look good either. So be honest with those citations. And then at the very end of the introduction, I recommend that you summarize the findings briefly, like here in this paper we show, because that really allows the reader to focus and move into the paper in the right mindset. And the results are the heart of the paper. So again, you want to order the experiments logically, not necessarily chronologically. You can use subheadings. So if you divide your result into subheadings, it's kind of like an outline of your paper. That can guide your writing, and it guides the reader through the story. All these subheadings should relate to the main takeaway of the work, so that's a good check after you've written your paper. Do they all go back, or are you veering off on sidetracks? Include essential, you know, methodological detail, but only enough to understand the main stuff. Save the rest for the methods. And for figures, kind of the same as results. A quick skim of the figures only should kind of generally convey the point of the story in the same way. So it should be a logical continuation of how you arrived at the answer to your question. Clarity is a lot more important than beauty, although beauty definitely helps. Each figure should really present a single concept or result, and ideally the caption should explain the point and what we should get from the figure without us needing to refer to the text. That way, if somebody's just browsing the figures, we can see exactly what that point we should be getting is. Okay, so convincing the editor. Your handling editor, you can think of them as your advocate. If you get them on your side, they will do a lot in their power to help you get the paper published. We don't go in hoping to reject papers. That would be a waste of everybody's time. We're all assigned based on expertise. We all have PhDs, sometimes postdocs, or I've even been professors in the general field, but we might not be experts in your specific area. So we read the entire manuscript. We kind of decide based on our editorial criteria for the journal whether it's suitable for that journal, and then we'll decide, you know, whether to send it off to peer review. If it's a multidisciplinary paper, let's say a nanocrystal paper that uses a lot of computational methods, or a nanocrystal paper that has some bio implications, multiple relevant editors will weigh in on it because sometimes different angles will have different levels of advance. So what are we looking for? Generally, we're looking for papers with potential. If we know the field well enough, we read it, we can tell, you know, is this paper likely to move the field in approximately 5-10 years? We recognize that the technical quality of the paper might not be there yet. It might not be a perfect paper, it might not have all the data that it needs, but that's what the peer review process is for. So we kind of judge it based on what we think the final product would have in terms of impact. That doesn't mean overhyping. Again, it's just if the data's there and we can kind of envision a version of the paper within a round or two of reviews that would get us there, that's what we're looking for. So the most important things to focus on in the first submission are, you know, making the significance and impact of the findings clear, the degree of advance, the support for conclusions in a kind of general sense, and generally quality data. Again, if the claims are great, but the data looks pretty questionable, that will make us feel a little bit uncertain about sending it out to review. Less important, don't worry too much about English grammar or language. Of course, it has to be readable and understandable, but don't spend too much time there or adhering to journal style. That's not important. It doesn't have to be a complete or perfect set of data. Again, that will improve during review. So a strong contender for review. This is Nature Communications level, but it's probably pretty relevant to a lot of similar journals. It will almost always address an important question for the field or solve an existing problem. It'll tell us something new and interesting. It'll represent a substantial advance over the previous literature, so an actual leap forward. You know, it actually moves the field forward in a significant way. And it'll present strong data, of course. It may or may not do these things. These are always added benefits. If it approaches a problem in a clever or unusual way, so, you know, will it inspire other researchers to also use this clever approach to tackle their own work? That could be a plus. It could be a very systematic approach to something. So not every paper we publish is like an extremely flashy, exciting thing. Some are just very systematic, rigorous works that are kind of bread and butter of the field, and we do publish those as well. It could describe something unexpected. You know, not every finding has to be expected. It just has to move our understanding forward. But if it's unexpected, you know, that's also great. It could be useful, either practically or technologically. And it could show generality. And of course, this depends a lot on the field and what topic the paper is under. Okay, so peer review. This is a meaty section. How we choose reviewers. Obviously, you want to choose very good reviewers because that's how the paper will become better. A good peer reviewer that we invite has, of course, technical expertise and knowledge of the field. A history of being fair and constructive. So at least for each journal, I have access to all Nature Communications reviews, so I can look up somebody that I might want to invite, look at their previous reviews, and see if they have tended to have very detailed but fair, constructive, big picture reviews. If they tend to be kind of vague, then you know I might reconsider inviting them. Good attention to detail, but can also see the big picture. It should really be a broader look at, does this paper advance the field? Will the community find it interesting? With some, you know, detailed analysis of the actual results. But a blend of both is very important. A good reviewer is efficient and reliable. If they tend to disappear or if they tend to be very, very late, I can also see that in the records, and I might think twice. Of course, that means that the better reviewer you are, the more likely you are to be asked often. So you can decide which is more important to you. Factors we consider, we always honor author exclusions. Just because you say this person has, they hate our work, we will not invite them. That would be bad and unproductive for everyone. We make sure we cover all the relevant expertise. We seek to increase diversity in the reviewer pool. So, you know, making sure that the same 10 people in a field aren't always reviewing each other's papers. We want to add new voices. So younger people that are, let's say, junior professors, even postdocs sometimes, those that are entering the field, underrepresented countries, more women. These are all things that we try to keep in mind. And of course, we're alert to inappropriate reviewer behavior. So if there's biases, arguments, we'll keep those in mind as we review, as we pick reviewers. So the role of reviewer is interesting. Some people think of themselves as gatekeepers, some as advisors. I personally recommend that you think of yourself as an advisor rather than a gatekeeper. But for us, reviewers assess the technical issues. So they make sure that the conclusions are supported, the data are of high quality, the controls are correct, the approach and analyses meet the general standards of the field, and that, you know, they have enough information for others to repeat the experiments. They only advise us on editorial issues, so these are things like significance, impact, advance, novelty. So they advise us on how much advances or overlap with previous work, the interest of the field, the potential impact on future research, but they don't decide this for us. So that's why it's important to make sure the editor is on board with your paper, because, you know, while they advise us, we can't overrule them on these editorial issues. So some trademarks for good reviews. If you're a reviewer and you want to make sure that your reviews are useful to us, the best thing is that your recommendation, no matter what it is, positive or negative, is supported with evidence and not just opinions. Often we get mixed reports, and it's really hard if I have two positive reports and one negative report, but the only thing the negative report says is this paper is trash or this isn't novel. Then it's really hard for me to go to the authors and say, I have to reject it because of this. They're going to be very upset with that. But if you instead say, you know, this lacks originality because this paper uses a very similar approach and go into the details of that, or this method is, you know, fundamentally flawed because blah, 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 then I can actually use that argument to argue why I should accept or reject a paper. So vague opinions are very difficult for us to use as support for difficult decisions. Make your feedback constructive and informative. So again, think of your role as a peer mentor to your community, and these are all people in your community that you're reviewing, not as a gatekeeper. So your job isn't to say, yes, no, get through, get not. You want to improve your community and by giving advice. Even if the paper should be rejected and is in really bad quality, try to offer suggestions for improvement. That will, over time, improve your community and the field. Even if you feel like you're reviewing someone who's more senior than you, the process is anonymous, so everyone's a peer. Don't feel obliged to back down, even if the other reviewers are positive, but you have a fundamental concern, you know, stick with it. Talk to the editor about how concerned you are, and we will try our best to make sure that that is, you know, really portrayed through our decision. Remember that someone's on the other side, and often those are students. So don't write anything that you wouldn't want you or your students to receive. You know, be civil, be professional. If you have confidential concerns, let's say you just don't believe anything from this lab, or you think the data is fabricated, if you don't think that's appropriate to put in the review itself that'll be transmitted to the authors, write it in the confidential concerns to the editor. I will say that it's helpful if you do convey some of those concerns in the comments to the author as well, because it's difficult when you get a review and the authors only see, you know, very minor detailed changes, and then the editor comments are, this is trash, nothing is here, this is terrible, because all I can do when rejecting the paper is say, I know it looks like this reviewer likes it, but trust me, like, confidentially they told me that they really don't. So try to convey some of those concerns in a professional way in the author comments as well. So to improve the speed and quality of review, again, the review process often takes long, and I know many people wonder why it takes so long. Don't overcommit. It's totally okay to say no. The best reviews are those that you've had time and the desire to spend time on. So, you know, ideally you won't say no to every single review request that comes your way from every journal, but if you're too busy, no problem. Please say no. Keep deadlines in mind. So if I invite you to review and I ask for it in 2 weeks, but you're really busy for the next month, say, you know, I can't review in 2 weeks, but is a month okay? Most of the time, that's totally fine. We'd rather have you review because we chose you, and we'll give you that extension. The earlier you ask for an extension, the better. The one thing I really encourage you not to do is, if you can no longer review, just tell us. We're not going to be angry. We're going to be much more angry if you keep promising that you'll send it, and then, you know, 2-3 months have passed, we've given you extensions, you suddenly disappear, the authors are yelling at us, where's your paper? Just tell us. Just say, you know, sorry, something came up, we understand there's life events, there's professional obligations, just don't disappear on us. If you can't make it, recommend newer colleagues. This is often how we know new names. If you have a student or a postdoc who just left your lab and is starting a new lab, recommend them, give us your email address. If you know colleagues that, you know, just aren't very mainstream, let's say I'm in the U.S., so I'm more familiar with the U.S. community. If you're in Finland, but you know a lot of Finnish colleagues, recommend those to us. That's how we add in new voices. I would use this opportunity to train your students and postdocs, but give them the credit. So, you know, provide their contact info and let us invite them. Don't just have them do it, but take the credit for yourself. That allows them to, you know, enter our reviewer pool as well. And consider transparent peer review initiatives. So at Nature Comms, we do allow the option to publish peer reports, and that can be very valuable to the community to see how a paper has evolved over time. Okay, so after a review, we take the ultimate responsibility for decisions. We often face contradictory recommendations, so we don't count votes, we always read arguments. We consider the expertise of the reviewer when considering arguments and which one to weigh more or less. And we do occasionally overrule reviewers, both positively and negatively. So how do we deal with these? Let's go into a little bit more detail. How powerful am I, and how powerful is that famed reviewer too, who always seems to hate your paper? So on editorial issues, the editor is really the most powerful. We decide the significance based on our own opinion, which started when we decided to send it out to review, as well as the referee's advice. We may decide a paper is interesting despite the fact that all the reviewers are not very enthusiastic about it. So that's why it's really important to convey the importance to the editor and get us to advocate for you at the very beginning. And even if the referees are kind of in support of publication, but those aren't the reasons that we like the paper, we can also overrule them on those aspects as well. On technical issues, the referees really have the most power here. So we generally can't overrule technical issues on our own. If there's a fundamental disagreement between the author and the reviewer, and it just does not seem to be going anywhere after a couple rounds of review, we generally enlist the advice of an arbitrating referee with the same experience. We say, can you please comment on these issues? Do you think they're serious? Are there ways that we can tone it down or add caveats so that it's publishable? Sometimes we may overrule certain referee requests depending on our own criteria. So that's, let's say, a referee says this really has to be generalized to a bunch of materials. We might say, nah, you know, for our journal, we don't need that. So once we have, you know, once we've made a decision based on those mixed reports, we have to decide whether to reject or offer a revision. Editorial considerations are the most important at this stage. So how enthusiastic are we to publish this as an editor? Do we like it enough to be patient while you perform more experiments, which could take, you know, half a year, even up to a year? For borderline decisions, we really want to avoid multiple rounds of review that exhaust the reviewers, it exhausts yourself, and it doesn't necessarily end up in publication for you. So do we think that the required work is within the scope of a revision? It's also very rare for a paper to improve an editorial interest over many reviews. So this is the biggest thing with the first editorial decision post-review. If nobody is really that enthusiastic, and we aren't really that enthusiastic, it's very unlikely that we would offer a revision because it's not obvious that that interest will increase. So we'd rather reject it then and allow you to come back to us if you have, you know, increased the impact of the work rather than saving you from doing all the technical revisions and then just rejecting down the line because it's just not interesting enough. The technical validity decides the scope of the revision. So if it's a major or minor revision, how much work is required, how much time in the lab will that take, are there major concerns that directly affect the claims, all these kind of play into that decision. So when you're invited to revise, remember that the goal of peer review is really to improve papers. Think of the reviewers as your collaborators in this process, not as obstacles to jump over. So I've, you know, seen numerous papers where the referees were pretty harsh. They made the authors do tons of new work. And in none of those cases, when we actually ended up publishing the paper, did the author say, that was really annoying, I really regret that. They've almost always said, yes, you know, the paper has really improved. I'm really glad. It was tough, but the end product is much, much better. Always do a good job the first time. You know, if you send us a revision and you've only addressed a little bit of the claims and it seems like you just kind of wanted to get it back to us, that hurts your credibility with both us and the reviewers. Reviewers hate to see their hard work has been ignored. If they've spent 10 hours reviewing your paper and suggesting things and you just dismiss them all, they're not going to be in a good mood reviewing your revision. We do give, you know, we give you some opportunities to improve your work, but we really try to avoid numerous rounds of review. So if you do a poor job with the first revision, we might just send it right back to you and say, nah, try again before we even bother sending this back to review. An effective point-by-point response. So always be polite to the reviewer. Thank them for their time. Keep language civil. Don't use capital letters and exclamation points if you disagree. Address the requests with new data when possible. Don't just dismiss them. If you can't address a specific point, so they ask for a new type of experiment that just isn't possible, just explain why. And be humble when approaching it. If you think the reviewer has misunderstood something, consider that you just haven't explained it well enough, not that the reviewer is dumb. If you take issue with a comment or with a referee, keep the response letter itself diplomatic and then add all those concerns to the cover letter to the editor. So we'll at least be aware of it, but the reviewer won't think that you have some negative opinion of them. Don't cherry pick reviewers' comments. So by that I mean, let's say the reviewer's comment was overall very negative, but they wrote something like, the paper is potentially interesting and the topic is hot. Don't answer it with, thank you for thinking our work is really interesting and timely. You know, I see this all the time, and the reviewers don't really like having those words put in their mouth. So make it easy on the reviewer. So, you know, highlight changes on the paper. Tell us exactly what revisions you made to the manuscript. That really helps them read the response letter and go through and makes everybody happier. How to disagree diplomatically. So always respond as the reviewer has good intentions, even if you think they don't. Just please do. Let's say the reviewer makes an incorrect argument or seems to have misunderstood something. You know, I see a lot of, the reviewer's wrong, clearly you have no understanding of the field, and I have to then send that letter back and say, please tone this down. You know, instead, say, we thank you for this comment, but we respectfully disagree because, or it's possible that you may have misunderstood this, I'm sorry we didn't explain it well enough, here's why I think we're mistaken. If they suggest something difficult to do or out of scope, you know, don't say this is completely unreasonable, this is clearly not the point of the paper. just say, this is a good suggestion, but we're not allowed, we can't really do these experiments because XXX. If the reviewer finds a novelty lacking, again, this may or may not factor into the editor's decision. So if we've already offered a chance to revise and the reviewers weren't that into the novelty, it's possible we've already overruled that and we don't really care about whether the reviewer finds the paper novel. Still, you know, say something like, we apologize that the advance was unclear. To clarify, this is why it is. So just kind of always approach it in a very, you know, giving them the best, assuming the best intentions of the reviewer, because nobody wants to be attacked. And again, they spent all this time trying to help you improve the paper. They really don't want to see you attacking their intelligence. Finally, appeals. So let's say that we end up rejecting your paper, and that happens. We might reject your paper pre-review or post-review. And we do make mistakes sometimes, or sometimes you might just think that, you know, the reviewers are ridiculous and you want to try again, or you might come up with new data that addresses all the concerns. So we do welcome appeals. We consider appeals on every single paper. But there's cases where it's smarter to appeal and where you probably shouldn't waste time appealing. If you have additional data that addresses all the concerns, so often this is if we rejected it for technical reasons. So all the reviewers said, you know, interesting topic, but the data just does not support the claims. We might reject it if we don't think that you can fix that within the scope of a revision. But if you know, take 6 months, get all the data, please do appeal because those papers are often ended up being published. If there are factual errors in the reviews or the editor's comments that you can specifically refute, we do welcome that. You know, I'm perfectly willing to admit that I've been wrong many times, and you can tell me why I'm wrong, and I might reconsider. If you have evidence of reviewer bias that you can substantiate, so let's say that it's clear from the reviewer's report that it's some person, and they say, you must cite blah, 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 and you say, I know this person, they're biased against me. You know, if you can refute it with evidence, that could be a reason to appeal. Decisions based on novelty or importance are often very difficult to overturn unless you've done new data that actually does improve the impact. So, you know, if all three reviewers and the editor weren't that thrilled about the advance of your work, just simply appealing and saying, no, but it is new, that we're probably not going to overturn that. It's also not a good choice if you want to get this published quickly. So sometimes I get appeals that are like, you know, you spent 3 weeks or 3 months in review. My student needs to graduate, and now you've ruined their chances of getting a postdoc. We want to appeal. Appeals do not take a short time. So they're our last priority. We're always overloaded with new papers, and those are what we give priority to. So, you know, it can take a month before we even look at your appeal. And even then, if we send it back to review, the reviewers might be like, oh, an appeal. And they're often not successful. So even if you appeal, everyone's re-reviewed it, we might still reject it in the end. So if you want to get it published quickly, appeals may not be the best way to go. So how to appeal? First, consider your case realistically, objectively if possible. Wait several days or whenever you feel like the emotion has been taken out of it. You know, don't send a fiery email back to the editor that day or live tweet the rejection, as I have experienced. Like, what a ridiculous rejection. I'm writing the appeal right now. Just take some time. Think about it like scientifically and rationally. Do argue scientifically with new data to support your case. Address all the issues raised in review, so don't cherry pick which things you feel like addressing. Treat it as a full revision. And then, you know, if the issues had to do with editorial things like impact, novelty, significance, you know, you can restate how the findings fit in with the field or why, you know, the novelty is actually better than a paper that we specifically cited as a reason to reject it. And this was a very good article that I read from the editors of Inorganic Chemistry, The 5 Stages of Rejection. I recommend checking it out. The link will be in the posted slide, so you don't have to write it down now. And how not to appeal. So poor appeals can really hurt your reputation to both reviewers and editors. Again, we see all your appeal history. There are people who appeal every single decision. That will make us take your appeal a little bit less seriously. Don't treat it as a free second chance. Again, we're always dealing with new submissions. If you are always appealing, that can annoy us over time, unless they're reasonable appeals. Don't cherry-pick phrases from the reports or take phrases out of context. So again, if you've got three very negative reports, don't say, reviewer one said our paper was wonderful, but wonderful was, you know, a wonderful topic. You know, just don't put in words and quotes that actually have nothing to do with what the reviewer said. Don't make unsubstantiated or unspecific claims of bias. You see that a lot. Don't talk about your reputation or publication record or general statements on the importance of a field, like nanoparticles are really hot. I can't believe that you rejected this. Plasmonics is great. You know, these things, sure, but they're published in many journals. Don't refer to celebrity endorsements. So, you know, let's say you went to a conference or you ran it by your colleagues that have big names and you said, this person said our work was really good. I can't believe that you don't. That doesn't really work. Don't emotionally manipulate us. Again, we're treating this very scientifically. Don't just rewrite the paper cosmetically, resubmitting it without an official appeal and hoping to get a different editor or reviewers. We do catch that, and then we are a little bit upset. Don't try to guess the referee's identities because we can't tell you yes or no. Puts us in a difficult position. And don't criticize previous papers published in the journal. So I can't believe that, you know, you accepted this when our paper is so much better. There's probably a reason we accepted the other paper that you might not know about. So the language of appeal. These may seem ridiculous, but I've seen them all. So there's the do you know who I am category. Like, I review for so many Nature journals. I know exactly what you're looking for. You reject all my work, but I have my publications in other high-impact journals. Clearly, you have some vendetta against me. You know, my H index is super high. This work was really well-received. It had major applause at some conference. People praised it. I mean, if you bring your work to a colleague and they praise it, that does not mean that I should publish it. Emotional pleas or threats, you know, like my student needs to graduate. This will really hinder their career. We put 5 years of work, collaboration across global, you know, international, different countries. I'll never submit to you again. You know, these are all things that I've seen, and, you know, I feel kind of bad. I am human. If, you know, somebody sent me a picture of the first author, they sent me the picture and said, this is the person. He is so sad. He's crying. And I felt very bad. They said he just deleted his entire thesis in a panic. You know, what am I supposed to do to that? I mean, it's a little tough. And then the, like, I have no facts to support this, but, like, referee two clearly doesn't know the field. They hate me. They're my enemy. Sometimes you recommended referee number two. So it's humorous when we see this, but, you know, support any kinds of claims of bias or vendettas. Okay, so summary of advice. Select a journal wisely and write for that journal. You know, don't just aim for the highest impact. Aim for what audience you want to read your work. Make sure your paper has a clear message, a very succinct, clear message, and isn't just an assortment of observations. We look for papers with potential, and we're willing to help develop a paper. If we really like the topic, we're okay with something that's kind of, I don't want to say preliminary, but in the early stages, and are willing to work with you and the referees to make it a paper that's really great by the end. Don't oversell, be honest. Make the most of your opportunity to revise the first time. Don't argue around it. Referees can also see through that, and in the end, you'll have a better paper. I almost guarantee it. We do consider appeals, but use them wisely. And if you have any concerns whatsoever, if you think that a referee's mistaken, if you think that, you know, there's something in the, some, you know, ongoing dispute in the field that we might not know about, just talk to the editor. You know, we're very open to trying to figure out these situations and resolve disputes. Again, we want to publish your paper. That's why we sent it out to review. We don't want to reject it after putting all that work into it. So, yeah, thanks for listening. I'm happy to take questions. You can also email me. That's my email. This is the link to the slides, which you can copy down. Again, remember, capital O. Yeah, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Okay, now Tero can start. Then Tero will be the first, and then you. Yeah.
Thank you. We're not supposed to ask any questions that we don't want to find in the net over some time, but maybe those I will ask during the lunch. Anyway, so thanks for the nice talk. Actually, it was nice to see all these statements, because often you are being on the other side of this email chain. It's kind of nice to see that similar kind of ideas are used by the editors that I also think. But I would like to make two points about, and I would like to hear also your comments on this. Nowadays, I think, especially Nature Science journals, the so-called Yellow Press of Science, is sort of pushing more towards gathering attention than let's say, communicating science. I mean, of course, both things are there, but compared to, let's say, what we had 20, 30 years ago, this is really a key thing here. I would like to hear actually how you feel this dilemma, which one comes first, and should we actually change the way we publish? Should we really go towards this kind of two-page news pieces and then supplementary information where we actually tell what we did? And the second question is about refereeing. You mentioned this. What is a good referee? And I agree with what you stated there. One additional thing I would like to point out that this actually referee should always make a refutable statement, so that actually all statements on which they are making, except maybe about the importance and interest, but all everything else they should be such that the authors can actually refute them, in the same way as we do in science.
Sure.
This you actually see often, that the referee makes statements that are not refutable, but the editor doesn't sort of seem to care. And I'd like to hear about your comment on this.
Sure. So the first question. So I've heard actually two arguments, and I agree with both, that the highest level journals are really into the flashy, exciting, not necessarily really well-developed, good science, or it's just all pushed into the SI where it's not going to be easily communicated. And I've also heard that some journals are too obsessed with being right, or that the science is right, and that can limit scientists, I would say, inclination to push a little bit bolder ideas that may not be perfectly proven, but are interesting ideas that will push the field forward that other people can consider and continue working on, but are not necessarily wrong, or there's caveats and toned-down claims in there. So I think I see it as a balance. I would say at Nature Communications, which is, of course, where I work, we don't try to go for the flashiest papers. We try to go for things that do represent a substantial leap forward, as in if somebody reads it, the next year or two may not be cited, but maybe in 5 years, once people have had time to think about the ideas, it proposes something that makes people think a little bit differently. Those are my favorite papers, where they're bold but supported with enough evidence that it's not necessarily wrong, but people aren't afraid to be wrong, because sometimes you interpret results wrongly, and people shouldn't be afraid to publish things like that. Yes, I would say, is your question, should all papers be?
Should we go more towards this type of thing where the main paper is just a description of the finding? Like you mentioned that actually we should always write things in terms of telling the importance of the finding first, and not so much focus on what actually was done.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
And we could maybe say, I mean, I kind of agree, because there are lots of journals out there. We need to read a lot of things. So maybe there should be a condensed way of actually communicating what you did. But then how to do it not without overselling is actually...
Yeah, so I don't mean that you shouldn't explain what you did. So not necessarily like a communication level where you just say, here's the results, go find our methodology elsewhere. So we do publish full articles. And what I mean by that is every time you explain what you did, you explain why you did it and how it answers the question. But you also include enough information in both the methods section and in the SI for somebody to repeat it. So all the info for how somebody can go take it and use it and continue to do research on it should be in the paper, but it should all be tailored towards answering the main question. And I guess it also depends on the audience, right? So if you're aiming for, let's say, nature or maybe nature chemistry or something that you want a broader audience to look at, and you're not necessarily aiming for a grad student to take it in the lab and repeat it right then and there, you might want to aim for like a journal that's aimed for specialists in your field, where reporting exactly what you did is a little bit more of the norm. But yeah, it's a mix of audience, it's a mix of journal, and what level of it, like, who's going to find the advance interesting. If it's a specialist community and you really want to convey the methods, you know, send it to a journal where they spend a lot of paper time, like space, on reporting methods. Does that sort of, I mean, what I mean is I don't think that you shouldn't not say what you did. You should definitely say what you did, but report observations, report methodology, but make sure that it's all centered around a clear message in order to have the reader come away with some kind of conclusion. So if you have a paper that's just a compendium of observations, that can be interesting, and there are journals that will publish this. I'm kind of tailoring this to the papers that I would see, where it's a bunch of beautiful data, but for us, you know, I want to know what we get out of that data. If it's a methods journal that would really appreciate the beauty of the data, you know, it might be a different journal.
Okay, maybe we go to the next one, right there. Thanks.
Hey, thank you for the really nice talk. I have two questions, and the first one is more of a personal one as an author. And I find, I mean, from your lecture, I could notice and observe that you mentioned that in the introduction, be very clear about what motivated the study. Many times I find this difficult aspect to adhere to, I mean, especially when we have serendipitous results. And I always struggle, I may be alone here, but trying to link the what is already known in that field and how I link my work to, you know, the introduction part. So this is something that, if you can throw light on how you can communicate serendipitous results, it would be great. And the second thing I have is more about the review process. TM introduced a cloud peer review process a couple of years back, and I happened to be one of the first at that time to submit a paper to Synlet. I was very happy with that because my paper got accepted. So, but anyway, I mean, I found that it was something of a novelty in the review process. Not sure whether they are still continuing with that, because I've not submitted to them for quite a while now. I just wanted to know whether you can throw some light on that, whether Nature has something like, or has tried something like that, or has plans on that, and how the cloud peer review actually works. That'd be great.
Sure. Okay, so question one was on, oh yeah, serendipitous. Yes, so that's a lot of research, as we know, you kind of find something interesting and then you go back to rationalize it. I think it's perfectly acceptable and actually good to frame it that way. So, you know, I see a lot of papers that are like, you know, we came up with this synthetic approach, and it's clear that, you know, that later on they just kind of went back and did it. That's not being honest, right? So it's mostly, you know, be honest about how you got the results. It's okay to say we report an approach, and explain how you kind of came across. You can even explain different things that you tried until you received, you know, obtained the result that is going to then motivate the rest of your approach. It's perfectly fine to say that things were discovered serendipitously, like as long as the actual discovery is something that's interesting and the results that you learn from it and can then convey to us. Please do be honest about the fact that, you know, you stumbled upon something, because a lot of science is that way. But again, in terms of framing it, don't do it chronologically. So that's where I would advise against. This topic is interesting. First we set out to try this, it didn't work. First we tried, you know, we set out to do this, it didn't work. And finally we did this. I would start with what you did and then bring in other things that failed to give mechanistic insight into why what you did worked, if that makes sense. And the second question about cloud reviewing is that where a like all the reviewers can interact with each other?
Yeah, I think they sent the paper to a lot of postdocs, maybe. I'm not sure about, but about 50 of them reviewed my paper.
Oh, wow, okay.
Yeah.
Which journal is this? I'm actually okay.
So
So I'm not familiar with that with that type of review system. Although that does sound great. I think that sounds similar to more of a preprint kind of policy. So where you would submit, let's say, your article to ChemArchive or BioArchive or just Archive, and people can comment freely on it. At Nature Communications, we have a like papers under review, which is a preprint, essentially preprint server, but it says, you know, this paper is being considered for Nature Communications, but you can comment on it during the review process so that they can be taken into account during review. So in those situations, anybody can really comment on it. The problem is that it's not invited reviewers, it's just the general public and who decides to do it, but it does allow the author to address those concerns in addition to the actual peer reports that they're getting from the journal. There are systems such as, I know eLife does a kind of anonymized chat system where reviewers will submit their reports and they can ask each other questions and debate, and that kind of prevents the like very iterative process of the editor sending this, you know, this. So I do really like that system, and I know at least at Nature we are talking about implementing something like that. I don't have any updates on that, but yes, we are definitely interested in kind of innovating the way that peer review works so that it's less, you know, very staggered steps, which takes a long time and doesn't really allow for, you know, communication between referees.
Okay, Gerrit, you have a quick question? Please wait for the mic. It will be recorded. Remember that. Think what you ask.
Okay, so the question I wanted to ask was, so some of my collaborators, they tend to call the editor on the phone before even submitting the paper, claiming that, well, to raise the interest. What is your opinion on that? Would you...
Please.
I can imagine one would not appreciate that, right?
Yes.
I send an email.
I'm talking about phoning. Hello, I have following things done.
Yes, I am not a fan of that.
That's what I thought, yeah.
Yeah. So in general, so different journals have different policies on this sort of pre-submission inquiry. In general, well, at least at Nature Communications and most Nature journals, we don't want any kind of pre-submission thing because... You know, our streamlined process is you submit it, and then it's assigned to the best editor. We look at it, and we hope to get you a decision within 7 to 10 days. If you email us a paper and say, please tell me if you think it's appropriate, I'm essentially doing my job, but in email where I'm going to forget about it. It's going to take longer than you'd actually have, you know, than to just get our actual decision. And then, you know, often I say, you know, I don't think it's quite enough, and then they decide to submit it anyway, so what's even the point? Calling is, yes, another level of...
investments?
Yeah, it's hard to say no. So same things at conferences when somebody comes up to you with a paper and says, what do you think of this? You know, I'm happy to look at it then. It's a little bit more comfortable than the phone. The phone, you're caught off guard. There's not really much else you can say besides, well, like, the topic sounds interesting, but I have to read the paper. I have to look into the references. I have to really figure it out. There's not much I can say over the phone as to whether I'm going to send it out to review. So you can certainly warn me that something's coming, which is great because then if it comes, I can make sure that it comes to me. You know, you can say, I have this general paper on this. Does it sound interesting to you? I'm not going to make you read it or decide right now. Just letting you know it's coming. That's totally okay. But yes, I think the calling to tell me all about the interesting amount of your work, just do that in the cover letter. I can read it on my own time.
Okay, got it.
Okay, thank you very much. I think now we close the session and thank Ariane once again. And